Desmond has a barrow in the marketplace. Molly is the singer in a band. I'm Paul McInnes, and welcome to Music Weekly from Guardian.co.uk. On this week's show, we'll be getting all globalised again when Senegalese star Baba Maal joins us and plays an exclusive track too. We'll have new music from Jamie T, LaRue and Enter Shikari in Singles Club. Michael Hahn explodes while remembering the Blasters in the feature with No Name, and we'll be talking back to you, the listeners. But first, it's time to rock up with Sonic Youth. Max the hero. Sonic Youth, godfathers of alternative rock, DIY legends, and perhaps the coolest wearer of sunglasses since the Velvet Underground. Would you concur, Rosie Swash?
What about Kanye West and his Venetian? I would concur.
And you put that in there, though. Yeah. That's good. So Rosie, yeah, I mean, they are a pretty iconic band, are they
Indeed.
Not?
They are, yes. They're sort of, and even though they're not, you know, only grunge, they are sort of the grunge band of choice. They formed in 1981 during a period that's sometimes called no wave in New York, meaning there was no definitive scene, and they forged their own sound and identity, which I think it's fair to say has inspired very many people, particularly bands like Nirvana, but also bands like REM, who it's not so explicit.
So, I mean, what is their actual sound then?
Well, Thurston Moore, who founded the group, whose group it is, was obsessed with Patti Smith, and as a group, they sort of talk about being inspired by the Stooges, various hardcore groups, but they took those rock influences and they sort of messed around with them in terms of they bastardised their musical instruments a bit. They played in with alternative tunings, which you can... So that's the kind of nihilistic grunge sound they've got to them. But they were also, you know, they're also quite an arty, highbrow bunch. And on their latest album, they reference this in their song titles, which is sort of like reference beat poet Gregory Corso and the Germs' Bobby Pin. And so when I met up with them a couple of weeks ago, I talked to Thurston Moore, who explained the meaning behind those titles.
When we're sort of writing songs, sometimes there's things that happen in them that, like, will remind us of certain things, and we'll sort of use the names of these bands to as working titles, you know, so it'll be like, oh, the Noise song or the MC5 song or whatever. I don't know, yeah, I mean, they're just sort of general influences. I mean, we don't really, we have no desire to be like anybody else. I mean, Gregory Corso was just, I mean, we sort of name-checked him in the song title because that title, Leaky Lifeboat, is directly taken from his words.
It's a great title.
Leaky lifeboat being, you know, his perspective of what it was like to be alive. You know, we're all in a leaky lifeboat. Sacred tricks in the no-tech sound. I wish I could be music on a tree.
Noise no lands on me. Levitating on the ground. I mean, you guys formed in the very early 80s. What was New York like
at that point, which is where you all met and came together musically and otherwise?
It was a completely different beast than what it is today. The city was kind of really downtrodden. That meant that you could actually live there without having too much money. I think it was kind of probably the very last period of New York's history where you had that kind of bohemian atmosphere where, you know, artists could sort of live by their own means and have a creative lifestyle, and that it still exists to some degree, but most people go outside to other boroughs of New York, such as Brooklyn. So it's not like that culture has disappeared. I mean, in parts of Brooklyn, like Bushwick and possibly Greenpoint, I mean, it's more typical of probably what downtown Manhattan was probably in the 70s and early 80s.
Was there a particular experience, you know, performance, show, club, or band, that anything like that you really remember being a really striking influence on what came, you know, after?
I wanted to sort of go there as soon as I started reading like Patti Smith's reviews of like television and going into the city in like 76 and seeing some of those bands, it was this real transition from the New York Dolls, because Johnny Thunders was still, he was like a big part of that scene, and he had a band called the Heartbreakers. And the Heartbreakers at one point was Johnny Thunders and Richard Hell, and Richard Hell was like putting, you know, he put out one of the first singles that was considered punk with Blank Generation. So there was kind of this newer, younger guard who were kind of getting rid of some of the flash and just sort of bringing in more like more ripped black and white kind of look. And of course, Patti Smith was really, her energy was really, really potent at that time as a performer.
I remember reading about Protest Records, which I know was a short-lived venture, maybe it wasn't, where you and Kim would sort of distribute records in stores to...
Protest Records was... It still does exist as a website,
protestrecords.com. So how does it work?
Well, it doesn't work. I mean, basically what I wanted to do is I was going to see... I saw some poetry readings by Ann Waldman, who's always been an outspoken kind of critic of administrations like, you know, the Reagan and Nixon administration. And I just thought it would be really cool to start a label that was just dedicated to people who had songs and words that were just sort of in protest. And, I sort of think like if it was in protest to anything, it doesn't have to be so specific about the war. And so I got together with a friend of mine who actually sort of helped work on the Sonic Youth website, this guy Chris Habib, and we sort of devised this thing of like, how can we give this music away free in the largest way possible? So we just created a website, and I just contacted a lot of people I knew who I thought maybe could record some stuff, and then I got just tons and tons of input, you know. And I was spending like an inordinate amount of time during the day sort of dealing with it, you know, disseminating all these emails that were coming through. There's a lot of hate mail I was getting. You know, just wait till they find those weapons of mass destruction. You're going to look so foolish with this stupid enterprise, you and your stupid friends and all this kind of stuff. Or I'm going to kill you, you know. You know, I was getting a lot of stuff. And at some point I was just like, okay, I gotta move on. I can't do this. And so I just put a capper on it. Then I was going to change it to visual art and just sort of have visuals up there. I was going to ask people for movies, you know, I was going to keep doing it. But I was thinking of like, what's the most popular thing on the internet? And we figured out that pornography was, and I was just like, well, maybe we should see if there's a lot of people in the internet porn industry who are anti-war. And if they would give their pornography in protest for free. I thought that would be really successful.
Make love
more.
Okay.
But we didn't, I figured, well, like, then I'd have to answer too many questions about that. That was sort of compromising. So. Before the second show.
One of your songs, Superstar, appeared on the Juno soundtrack, and you also appeared in Gilmore Girls, and
yes.
This very weird episode where there was loads of different
yes.
singers. You know, is there something about Sonic Youth, do you think, that it either appeals to or is inspired by the plight of the adolescent girl?
I don't know. I mean, Gilmore Girls, the creator of Gilmore Girls, the woman was a fan of ours, mm-hmm. and her husband, who worked on that show. They name-checked us a few times in the dialogue between some of the kids on the show, and which was shocking because we were watching that show with our daughter who introduced it to us and who was the perfect age at the time, which was like 13 years old. And then we would hear our name once in a while. We'd just look at each other and we're like, what's going on? And so we actually sort of contacted then when we were in LA, Kim and I, and they were like, oh, come on down to the set. And then we went to the set, and then they said, like, oh, we want to do a show where you guys are on, and, you know, bring your daughter and all this kind of stuff. And that's just sort of, it was actually a very just for a friendly thing. You know, there wasn't much going on there beyond that. I don't know. I think a lot of people who actually work in the realm of television and cinema, you know, grew up with us as sort of a factor in probably their lives as far as listening to music. And some of them actually like us.
That was Thurston Moore and Steve Shelley of Sonic Youth, and their album The Eternal is out on Monday.
Great. Alex Needham, you join us here today. Alex Needham.
Hello.
Hello. How are you? I have three questions for you, Alex Needham.
Go on.
Will Gordon Brown survive the week?
Oh, God.
Quick answer, come on. We're not here to dilly-dally.
Yes, he will, yeah.
Was the Eminem Bruno bomb inhaling incident a fix?
Yes.
Are you pleased to be here?
Yes.
In that case, we can begin this week's singles club with Bulletproof by LaRue. That was LaRue with Bulletproof. LaRue are a band, not a solo act. So says Ellie Jackson, aka synth popper LaRue. And let's face it, she'd know. LaRue is translated from the French for ginger-haired freak. Alex.
Apparently it's a mistranslation. It should actually be either LaRue or LaRousse.
Boom. Boom, nailed. Grammatical challenges nailed by Nido.
I really like this record and the sort of where she is at the moment. She's kind of really in the zone that pop stars sometimes get to, like in the first 6 months of their career when they're becoming really massive. And I still always find it really fascinating to watch. Obviously, it's interesting because she's almost in a bit of competition, Beatles and Rolling Stones style, or Pet Shop Boys and Erasure style, with Little Boots, who everyone was tipping at the beginning of the year. And I've interviewed both of them recently, and they kind of confounded expectations in that everyone had told me that, you know, LaRue was quite difficult and Little Boots was really easy going. But I found the opposite. LaRue was like really chirpy, as he would be after having had, you know, a huge hit as she did with her last single. Whereas Little Boots was a little bit on the surly and monosyllabic side. Although, to be fair to her, I did her at 5:30 in the afternoon and she said she'd been doing continuous interviews since 8:30 in the morning. But I don't know. I mean, obviously all artists hate it when you compare them, but it's always exciting to the pop fan, I think, just to kind of judge how different people are doing, what's working and what isn't.
And what would be your top line summary comparison between the two?
My top line summary between the two is that LaRue's going to storm it and Little Boots might end up in the slipstream.
This is the third single we've had, Quicksand In For The Kill and this. How do you think this figures?
I think that this is just a completely straight ahead, irresistible pop song. I mean, it sounds very like the work of Vince Clarke, you know, particularly his early 80s stuff with Depeche Mode and Yazoo as well. And it just seems, after she's done slightly spiky, difficult things, it's like just hits the sweet spot, as the Americans would say. I just think it's a perfect pop song.
Rosie, what do you make of it?
I really love this one. It was the one that I liked most when they sent out the sampler EPs. And I think because if you like her, it's kind of a condensed, undiluted version of what she can do. But it also has that ability, I think, there's an edge to her voice. Like, you can either be totally seduced by it, or if you don't like it, it can really set your teeth on edge. And it's really in your face. I think the hook's fantastic. It did reminded me of Yazoo, even though she obviously sounds nothing like Alison Moyet. But that kind of production. I think it's really good. People have sort of said that she's quite sullen and all that sort of stuff. And then I looked at the video for this, where it's just her in a room in various costumes and various set designs, not smiling quite a lot. And it reminded me of the Sugar Babes, the way they would make these absolutely brilliant pop songs, but do it with a look on their face like they were going to headbutt you. I actually quite like that.
That proves that an irresistible combination, yeah, to them. The thing I like about LaRue the most is her voice. It's her singing voice, which is fabulous, but also quite quirky in a way. It has odd notes to its scale. And secondly, I think The one thing about LaRue that I think is not quite there, and this is her and her songwriting production partner, because they are a duo, is that I don't think the melodies are quite there yet. I think In For The Kill, which I like and I'm still listening to, but mainly that Scream remix, I think is kind of two notes short of a great melody. And I feel the same about this one as well. It will stick in your head, but it's quite a simple refrain, I think. Bulletproof by LaRue is out on June the 22nd. Second track on Singles Club is Juggernaut by Enter Shikari. That was Enter Shikari with Juggernaut. Enter Shikari is a formal phrase from sumo wrestling, where a tired wrestler calls for a stool to support his flagging buttocks. The stool is called a shikari, hence Enter Shikari. A juggernaut is a sumo wrestler's preferred form of transportation, as it makes him feel like a big man. And my choice, Enter Shikari. James Richardson accused me the other week of always making willfully idiosyncratic choices on Singles Club, and I'm hoping to conform this week. I saw them play the Leeds Festival a couple of years ago, and I kind of went there under duress because I'd heard they were a cross between like drum and bass and emo stroke hardcore, and lo and behold, they were. But they were an amazing spectacle live, and drove. They got the wildest crowd reactions of the entire weekend, and it was incredibly spontaneous. And the way that they mixed their blend of music was to very much separate it down the center, so you'd have a rock bit and then you'd have a rave bit and then it'd stop and then you'd have a rock bit again. Now I think this is still following that formula to a certain extent in this tune, but I think they've put more things into it this time, and I quite like it for that. It's got those emo contra melodic singing things going on. But it's also got Mike Skinner-ish rapping right in the middle, that kind of slightly excruciating bit we heard there about what are we going to do with this home that we built or didn't build or live in or whatever. There's hardcore screaming, there's raving elements. And then the chorus, which is my favourite bit of it, is something that you could imagine being done by Muse. And I think that they've managed to... They're a proposition that is not something that would normally sit on my CD player, but I do think that what they do is clever. And to a certain extent, original. Rosie.
I agree that it is original, and I do think it's clever. I like the lyrics in this song, which that bit you heard where I also thought, wow, that sounds a lot like Mike Skinner. I think it's his way of talking. That is there, you know, what's going to happen to our planet or the global economy in a way that's not completely cliched or that we haven't heard before and still quite genuine, which is hard to pull off. And I don't really know what to make of the way that they constantly change, like literally bar to bar tempo, and one minute we're rave, one minute we're just going to go completely slowly and be like a weird trance track. It's they've got an element of paranoia and fantasy to all of their lyrics, which is a little like the way that the Klaxons take on the futuristic concepts. But obviously, musically, they've gone in a different direction. I can't say I enjoy listening to it, but I appreciate that they exist.
That's an interesting point in comparison, actually, the Klaxons, because Klaxons do similar things to kids.
In a really pop way.
In performance situations. Alex, what do you think of the final line of the song? The idea of community is one that could be displayed in a museum.
Very touching. I preferred it to the line where he talks about bleary-eyed seeds. We've got to stop planting these bleary-eyed seeds.
I knew instantly what he was talking about.
I didn't know seeds had eyes.
No, maybe they don't.
But then I'm nearly 35.
Maybe it was a reference to Hazel Blair.
Yeah, exactly.
Very good. That would be extremely topical. I kind of appreciate it rather than like it. Funnily enough, they're not totally out on their own now, are they? Because Pendulum, I'd put in a similar bracket, and I think last year they did slay the festivals, as they say. In fact, I remember seeing Tea in the Park on TV, and their performance, people were going absolutely bananas. Obviously, Enter Shikari, they were famous for becoming very successful without a record deal and having, you know, loads of young fans who they'd got through touring. So you've got to kind of admire the fact that they've done it themselves. But as a hybrid, I mean, it's not something that I'd ever listen to. And the bit about I like what you've done with the place. It did bring the air of changing rooms into their kind of rock rave, you know, cauldron.
I think that's the point, though, isn't it? And there is some kind of, you know, this is their attempt at kind of using the language of fin de siècle imagery from telly just before this era of decadence is about to come to an end, mm-hmm. and maybe doing it a bit candidly. That's Juggernauts by Enter Shikari, and it's out now. Last track this week is Sticks and Stones by Jamie T. Drunk and being sick, I feel like shit, I gotta quit. I hope I ever miss a lot and got me stuck in Anderson Wick. With a voice across the platform shouting lightweight prick. I'm a featherweight champion, cheap to get pissed. Wish Candy were here with a bitch, she'd have to deal with it. Tell them all I shut their mouths and go suck their mama's dicks. But seeing that she ain't all of them, three fingers down, all the other two up, and I'll sing this proud. Running with believers, don't tell me. That's Jamie T with Sticks and Stones. Jamie T is short for Jamie Trays. And the rapper, rocker, raconteur is in fact heir to the Tray Empire. So next time you serve your mum breakfast in bed, remember Jamie T gets a tenner. Rosie Swash.
Yes, how could I follow such an intro?
Well, it's just by saying something that's truthful and accurate.
Well, yes, critics of Jamie Trey do tend to question his authenticity as the sort of geezer that he projects himself as on stage. But I don't think that actually that's what he's about. What I like about him, music aside, which I'll talk about in a second, is what do we really know about him? No one really knows that much about him. He's done a few interviews. We did when his first album came out, but you don't see him like falling out of Bungalow 8 with a famous girlfriend. He still drinks in the same Wimbledon pubs that he used to and hangs out with the same people that he's always known, who are quite a weird bunch of people. And he sings about what he sees and what he experiences. And he does it in a way that everybody can relate to, even if you're not that kind of particular English male living that kind of lifestyle. I do think maybe you need to be, you need to be English to appreciate some of the nuances of his music. And the music itself, I think this album, from what I've heard, and I've heard most of it a couple of times, is a bit more mature than his first album, and a little bit less, this isn't a great example of it because it has got that really anthemic chorus, but a little bit less relying on the kind of, you know, the geezers in the crowd to go mental for you, and playing up what he's also excellent at, which is sentimentality. The album is very good, and he's not changed, but he's just kind of evolved.
Great stuff, Rosie. I wondered about the music, the sound of it. Mm. It's a little bit different from the first album, this single. One, is this indicative of the sound on the album at large?
Well, yes and no. I found this one the most like his old stuff. There's a lot more slowy ones. You don't get any ballads. I don't think that's ever going to happen. But he's still using very, very simple, very effective percussion, ways of playing around with percussion and guitar and bass guitar. And that's kind of about it. It yeah. often sounds like more's going on, but it's not really.
I think for me, there was more guitars in this than perhaps the entire first album put together. And it almost sounded like something you could hear a mainstream indie act thinking of, perhaps The Enemy or something. It's chopped up and it's looped up, but that sound is a little bit different. I'm just wondering if that's apparent elsewhere, or if this is something they've chosen for the lead off.
I don't think this is that similar to stuff on the rest of the album. When I saw him live at the end of last year, when he was playing to some of his fans, this was the one that, as soon as I heard it, I thought, that's so going to be the single. That's so obviously going to be the single.
Alex, do you have anything to say on the authenticity issue?
Well, I don't think it really matters as long as you're not completely lying. I mean, if you sort of pretend to be a yob and a kind of hard man, it's a bit embarrassing if you're, you know, soft and called Tarquin. I do think he puts across quite a yobbish persona in the video for this, which I watched earlier. There's him and his mates all kind of chucking bottles at the camera and pouring beer over each other. I find that a bit of a turn off, really, just because it's been done so much, and there's nothing kind of clever about it. And he obviously does have an intelligence, but I don't necessarily connect with it that much. And one thing I was thinking is it's just very kind of West London, the way that it all is. You know, like the Clash. Well, he's a big Clash fan, but it's that sort of, it seems to express that kind of scuzzy Notting Hill, maybe slightly Tristopherian, you know, eye view of the world. And it's not something that I massively get on with. But then again, Wimbledon's a very different place. I couldn't quite see what he was totally driving at in the lyrics. Obviously, it starts off with these reminiscences of kind of underage drinking, which are quite kind of nicely done. And then is there some heroin aspect of it later? There's some mention of a shooting gallery, but I didn't know whether that was.
I like the line, "It's the only place where I feel relaxed enough to crap," which I thought was, it's interesting. I've never thought about it in those terms too, but maybe we've all got a favourite place in that regard. That was Jamie T and Sticks and Stones, and it's out on June the 29th. Over on the blog, you piled in with a few reviews of last week's tracks. This Is Me Typing My Name wrote, "About the Jordan Sparks track, I despise it with every ounce of my being for being pompous, overblown and melodramatic. But I can't stop listening to it, as it somehow gets bloody great hooks into your brain. It is, essentially, the perfect pop single."
What? I hate it. I love it. Bass Monkey wrote, "Wave Machines wasn't my bag at all, just too nerdy. Like Rebecca Nicholson, I think Nigel had a weird kind of 80s authenticity, whereas for some reason I don't like a lot of the current synth pop that references that period. I'm not sure why, it feels repressed somehow, nerdy. Whereas the Nigel track might be a bit nerdy and repressed too, but at least it's pretty. Maybe that's it."
Nescaf offered a mysterious response to Wave Machines, simply writing, "Wave Machines, I shall investigate further."
Ooh.
Maybe perhaps that was just an automated response. So we want your reviews of this week's tracks. Jamie T, Enter Shikari and LaRue on our blog at guardian.co.uk/musicweekly. Tell us what you think of every single one of those tracks and these others that are out to buy next week. All American Rejects, I Wish. Katy Perry, Waking Up in Vegas. Hatchim Social, Crocodile. I'm a gentleman by day. Mark Evans, Tonight's the Night. All right, that there's your montage. Thanks to Alex Needham for coming in, joining us today.
Thank you very much.
You were at Primavera Sound at the weekend. Was it good?
It was fantastic, yeah.
Was it? Did it live up to your expectations?
It did. I've been a few years. I first went in 2003, and it's just brilliant all the time. It's amazing to have a festival that's warm, not overcrowded. Everyone's really up for it. And the sound on the main stage was so unbelievably loud. Really? That it was like a jet engine landing right on your head.
And it's quite a varied bill, which kind of very pitchforky, as you described it to me. Which bands kind of that you hadn't heard much about before or didn't know much about before did you come away liking?
Well, I went to see Michael Meyer, the kind of minimal techno DJ, at 4:30 in the morning.
And he was critical faculty switched on.
I mean, I saw Ghostface Killah, who you don't often get the chance to see, who was amazing. I didn't see My Bloody Valentine when they played last year, so they were great. And I thought the Horrors had kind of mixed reception from the critics out there, but I thought they were just great. Uh-huh.
Fantastic. Well, thanks again for coming in, Alex. Hope to see you soon. That's it for this week's Singles Club, though. You can catch the texticular version online, guardian.co.uk/music, each Wednesday. Now, Music Weekly, Barbara Marl. That's The Internationale by Barbara Marl, our first Senegalese guest. but it ain't going to be our last, Rosie.
Is that right?
Yeah, I make a promise to you, I'm going to get Akon.
Shoot.
Tell us about Barba Mal.
He's not particularly big over here, but he is one of the biggest pop stars in Senegal. He sort of ranks alongside Youssou N'Dour. He's something of a kind of pop maverick. Although he comes from a traditional Senegalese rural background, he has just done about every different musical style you can imagine. And with his latest album, which is one of about 20, he worked with New York-based electronic group Brazilian Girls, which is a bit weird because they are about as far away as you can get from Senegalese music. The album itself is called Television, and when Barba Mal was in our studio recently, he explained to me the meaning behind it.
Television is something really, really coming in the houses of African people. The impact of television is getting very big on the continent, and I think also it's an opportunity to make people to be together, to share information, ideas, projects.
So it's a good thing, or?
I think it's a good thing in Africa to have something that can bring people together, at least, because most of the information comes from the governments or the administration. But through television, where people just have the fascination to come to see their culture, to listen to their music, it's so close to them that they're going to listen. And if you use that to educate and to say and to give information, I think it's very good.
Two songs in the album which I like the most are International, which is a really unusual, sounding song, and The Power of Women is the other one, which is has quite a sad melody.
Yeah.
Are you saying women will become empowered?
Yes. The first idea is to talk to Africans and to say to them, it's possible. We have the power of young people who have the desire to achieve things, to be connected to the rest of the world. And we have also the power of women who used to be far away, left behind in the houses, making food for the other people, trying to keep the harmony of the family. But now, since 10 years now, you see women are coming out of the families, standing up and trying to achieve things. We should use this power to make something happen. This is why I write this song. One of the lines of the song don't come from me. It's an old proverb where people say that this is what you women should do. For a long time, you should stay at the house, take care of your husband. I say that's true. But now we need them to keep that, but at the same time to have another responsibility.
I wanted to ask also about the involvement of the Brazilian girls. They're from New York, right?
They're from New York.
New York electronic bands. And I know that their style of music is... It fuses a lot of different things, a lot of different genres, but I was still quite surprised to see the two of you working together, really different, in my opinion, quite different artists. Mm. How did that come about?
I knew exactly that I wanted to do something where people are not going to say, it's an African musician. Yes, I'm just a musician, and I want to share my experience of life from my childhood, the things that I listened to, I grew up with, and my experience to share it with other musicians who come from different environments. So I was talking to some of my friends, like Barry Reynolds, who said to me, you should meet these people, the Brazilian girls, especially Didi and Sabina, because they like to talk, they like to exchange ideas and to think, and it did affect their way of writing their songs. And this is how everything, the collaboration between me and them just come.
Quite consistently try and educate people about where you come from. Mm. Because you've been quite vocal before about how you feel about certain politicians and people like Bob Geldof and their approach to changing Africa.
I know that people are trying to do their best to achieve things for Africa.
But do you think it's...
what Bob Geldof, Bono and all these people are doing, I think it's really good. I just... there is a point of view and a place to have a different angle or to view the process, you know. I'm from Africa. I know I travel in small places, small villages. I play there. I listen to people. And I think people are just taking care about them, not especially people in the big cities because they have more facilities. Mm-hmm. But in the small places where people just, when they're desperate, they travel and come to the big cities and come there with no education, no focus in what they can do, and they face all the difficulties, you know. This is these people that we want to be involved in all the process. And it's these people who's going to make it grow. If they don't know what you're doing for them, they are not in the process, nothing can happen. You can rise. All the money you want is going to go in the pocket of the governments, but it's never going to arrive to these people who's going to use it.
That was Barbara Marl talking about his album Television, which is out now, and he will play the Meltdown Festival in the South Bank alongside jazz legend Ornette Coleman on the 15th of June.
Super. And also stay tuned for an exclusive live track from Barbara Marl at the end of the show. You want some feature with no name? You can't handle some feature with no name. Okay, you can. Here's Michael Hann on The Blasters.
July the 4th, 1985, and Jason and the Scorchers are headlining an Independence Day lineup of American bands at the Electric Ballroom in Camden. Before the Scorchers, though, there's a rockabilly band from LA. They take to the stage looking like a bunch of greasers on the prowl for a fight, and they don't say a word before they launch into a hard, fast, intense version of a Shakin' Stevens song. At that point, being 15, I didn't realise the Blasters, the band on stage, were the writers of Marie Marie. Nor did I realise they weren't just a rockabilly revival act, like many of the others that came and went during the early 80s. Rather, they saw themselves as simply the latest practitioners of something that had never gone away. The native music of working-class America, the America they'd grown up in. As young men in the blue-collar LA suburb of Downey, the two key Blasters, the brothers Phil and Dave Alvin, Phil singing the songs that Dave had written, played with visiting R&B legends and immersed themselves in rock and roll before forming the Blasters just as punk came to LA. The Blasters weren't a punk band musically, but they were in every other way. Their music was diametrically opposed to the mainstream. They were angry and confrontational men, and they were willing to play to crowds who were happy to despise them. And so they became part of LA's punk scene, playing rock and roll music in the spirit of Jerry Lee and Little Richard to crowds who'd come to see Black Flag or Fear or X. It didn't matter if the record had been made in 1962 or 1977 or 1982, if it had the right spirit. The most exciting music the Blasters ever made was at the very start of their career. A self-recorded LP made for a rockabilly freak called Rockin' Ronnie Weiser, who'd moved from Europe to California. Or the moderately cleaned-up versions of those songs they recorded for LA's leading indie label, Slash, a year or so later. And when they did sign to a major, they came under the inevitable pressure to have a hit. And a rock and roll band who looked like a biker gang, with a fat piano player, and an elderly saxophonist who played on Fats Domino's original hits weren't all that likely to offer stiff competition to Starship or Cyndi Lauper. One of their very best studio recordings, a hypnotically effective rave-up called Kathleen, was left off an album by Warners for sounding too much like the Blasters. But in the 6 years of their original lineup, they helped spark a revolution in attitudes to American roots music, making it something that young musicians with attitude could once again play with pride. By the time I saw them, the game was nearly up for that first lineup of the Blasters. Dave Alvin left a few months later, and though the Blasters continue to play, it's as an occasional touring band playing the old non-hits. But don't think the members are now just middle-aged cabaret artists. Dave Alvin, especially, is still making vital music. A few years back, his album Public Domain gathered up old American folk songs and won him a Grammy in the process, and perhaps provided a model for Bruce Springsteen's Seeger Sessions album. He's got another excellent record out any minute now, Dave Alvin and the Guilty Women, which caused someone to knock on my car window the other day when I was stopped and asked me what that amazing music on my car stereo was. I guess I could have answered with the title of the song that opened the Blasters' very first record on Rockin' Ronnie Wise's label. It's American music. Well, in U.S. Soldier Boy, on leaving West Berlin, no music there that rocks, just 1,000 violins. They want to hear some American music. American music. They want to hear that sound right from the USA. Well, it can be sweet and lovely. It can be hot and mean. One thing's for sure, it's always on the beam.
That was Michael Hann, Stroke the Blasters, and Featured with No Name. We'll be back next week. Rosie, the blog time.
Yes, there were some positive vibes from EJD, who on spotting the blurb for our text that last week said, ooh, looking forward to that. While Scopey said of last week's guest, good work, guys. Really enjoyed it. Hot chip rock. Do I get a T-shirt?
Unlikely, it seems. But Bass Monkey, our close friend and in no way a nerd, offered some insightful observations, saying it was an interesting podcast. Hot Chip have always passed me by and I still don't get them, but the thing with your interviews is that a lot of these artists come across as interesting and nice people. That's the beauty of the podcast for me. I never liked Keane, for example, but after hearing them interviewed on the pod, an active dislike has matured into a kind of acceptance. God, that's incredibly tolerant. I think that's just the niceness of Rosie Swash. She brings out the niceness in people. Anyway, same with Hot Chip. Don't like their stuff, but they seem like nice enough guys and I no longer resent their success. Phewy, Bass Monkey, we're glad to hear that. New Facebook friends, hi to Mary Knox, Rob James, Jennifer Sullivan, Reporte Indigo, Teresa Ferreira, David Harrow and Tony Guilfoyle. That, however, brings us to a close for this week. We'll be back next Friday. Playing us out, here's Barbara Marl.
Kodum woni faroma.
got no handy. Ko jamanu rewbe rewbe kamme sukabe yeton ararai amtare lady mendi pendenenam tinno pendenenam tinno tinno ender sudumada Pitoda hodi be mada kodungo ni faro Pendenenam tinno Pendenenam tinno Tinno inder besngu mada Pitoda jomkale mada kodungo ni bure Yajiyo mansaluye Yaji non mansaluno Jom kalemada kodungo ni faro